Yeah, WOIT Madison.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. China is raising tariffs on US imports to 84%, the latest tit-for-tat move that threatens billions of dollars of trade between the world's two biggest economies. China announced the additional tax shortly after an extra 50% levy came into force on Chinese goods sold in America. Beijing blamed Washington for the escalation, saying President Trump was piling mistake upon mistake. Here's our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow.
At this levels of tariff, exactly what is going to be traded? Because perhaps the tariff price is going to push up prices so much that it's just not worth buying those goods from each other's countries. Just give you an example, a couple of years ago, China sought to punish Australia for certain political things, and it put 100 to 200% tariff on wine. The wine trade with Australian wine trade with China just collapsed. So you got to wonder how much left of US-China trade there will be if these tariffs continue for any length of time.
The global trade war over tariffs has caused mayhem on the world's financial markets. European and Asian shares tumbled again. There's also been a big sell-off of long-term US government debt or bonds, which are usually considered a safe asset. Analysts suggest some investors now see America as a riskier prospect or need more funds to cover recent losses. Here's our Deputy Economics Editor, Darshini David.
Normally, when you have this kind of unease and unrest, money goes into bonds. It doesn't come out of bonds, which has raised some questions. What exactly is going on? Who is one of the biggest holders of American debt, American bonds? It's China. And that, you can see, is exactly why some investors are getting slightly concerned, saying, hang on a minute, as part of this retaliation, as part of this action, is China actually withdrawing its support from America in this way?
Germany is about to announce a new coalition government after weeks of haggling. The deal was made more urgent by the Trump tariffs and the global trade war. Friedrich Merz of the conservative Christian Democrats will be the new chancellor. Medics in the Gaza Strip say at least 29 people have been killed by Israeli strikes in the east of Gaza City. Dozens of wounded have been taken to hospital. Others are thought to be buried under debris. From Jerusalem, Yolande Nell has this report.
Video shows the dust-covered bodies of young children being carried away from the rubble by distraught relatives and rescue workers. The multi-story building that was bombed was in Shejaia, east of Gaza City, but locals said it was not part of the area which Israel told to evacuate last week. The Israeli military said it had targeted a Hamas operative responsible for planning and carrying out attacks, and that it had taken steps to mitigate harm to civilians. Hamas described what happened as a bloody massacre.
Yolande Nell reporting. World News from the BBC.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is going on now, all over Madison until April 10th. There are over 170 films of all shapes and sizes for you to choose from. This includes some of the best cinema from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. Choose from comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. You can catch these films at the Bartell Theater, the Barrymore Theater, and four venues on the UW campus. The last 4 days of the festival will take place at Flick's Brewhouse, located at the Easttown Mall. A guide to all the films and where they will be shown is available in the March issue of the Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The Wisconsin Film Festival is happening now through April 10th on a screen near you. helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years. This is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. Natty Nation blends authentic reggae with elements of rock, soul, and funk to create a unique Midwestern sound. Natty are joined by Czar, a genre-bending collective that blends the sounds of psychedelic rock with groovy, rhythmic soul and funk, along with your hosts, DJs Trichome and VPS. More information can be found at high-noon.com. The High Noon Saloon presents Natty Nation's Almost 420 Reggae Party with special guests Czar and hosted by DJs Trichome and VPS on Saturday, April 19th at 7 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. Live music lives at WORT Madison.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 9th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Ursula Knudsen-Lata. Ursula Knudsen-Lata is the Legislative Director for Peace Building at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, where she lobbies Congress to establish peace building as a central goal of U.S. foreign policy. She says the recent foreign aid cuts have done immense harm to vulnerable people across the world. And so recently, the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance, co-chaired by the Friends Committee and Bread for the World, brought leaders together for a series of meetings on Capitol Hill on foreign aid. So Ursula Knudsen-Lata will be joining me to tell us more about this action. And also joining me later will be Omar Ocampo, researcher at the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted to talk with him about his latest piece at inequality.org, Liberation Day Tariffs Will Concentrate Wealth Even More, he says. And he says, Trump's trade war is a class war designed not to revitalize American manufacturing, but to weaken progressive taxation. So he says to boost domestic manufacturing, tariffs need to be implemented and targeted towards industries with relatively low but growing demand. Renewable technologies, electronic vehicles are two examples. So stay tuned to hear from Omar Ocampo. Then later, a replay from Wart News on Monday. The piece, Madison takes part in nationwide hands-off protests against Trump administration. Stay tuned to hear that. Stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back. It is 10 minutes after 8, and joining me is Ursula Knudsen Lata. She is the legislative director for peace building at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, where she lobbies Congress to establish peace building as a central goal of U.S. foreign policy. And she says that the recent foreign aid cuts have done immense harm to vulnerable people across the world. And so she recently, an FCNL recently with Friends of the Earth, convened the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance. They brought together leaders in Washington for a series of meetings, and I wanted to talk with her about this organizing. Hey, good morning, Ursula Knudsen-Lata. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I want to kind of jump into this, you know, 90% cut, right, on foreign aid. Earlier this year, can you talk about this, the dollars lost and what it was used for? We'll start there.
Absolutely. So at the start of this new administration, several executive orders and memos were released in quick succession that initially froze and required a stop work order on nearly all U.S. foreign assistance around the world. That has then led to terminations of 90% of those programs. So what was originally meant to be a pause has become near permanent. What that looks like is about 5,500 grants out of 6,000 grants and contracts made by USAID, amounting to about $54 billion. Additionally, 4,000 of the 9,000 grants and contracts that the State Department ran have also been eliminated and amounting to another $4.5 billion. So we're looking at about $60 billion in cuts, which is still less than 1% of the federal budget. But those $60 billion allowed the U.S. to be the world's largest provider of food, medical, and humanitarian aid globally. It supported efforts like demining in countries across Southeast Asia. It supported peacebuilding efforts across Africa and Central America to help reduce violence. It really provided critical, both immediate needs to millions of people around the world who are suffering from AIDS, tuberculosis, and other infectious diseases. It provided food assistance to starving children, and also looked at long-term drivers of instability and supporting economic growth around the world. So it's really having a global ripple effect.
You know, I love your job goal that you lobby Congress to establish peace building as a central goal of U.S. foreign policy. Can you talk about conflict prevention and peace building programs that are funded through the foreign aid programs?
Absolutely. So first, peace building and conflict prevention is one of the most cost-effective things the U.S. government can invest in. A recent report last December by the International Monetary Fund found that for every dollar we invest in preventing violent conflict, saves $26 to $103 in the cost of conflict. So that's both the cost of military action, but also rebuilding lost economic output, humanitarian assistance required by the conflict. So it's an incredibly cost-effective tool, and it's also a tool that the first Trump administration supported. President Trump signed the Global Fragility Act in 2019, and the Global Fragility Act really says, let's take several pilot countries and regions, really invest in them over 10 years, and really show how impactful conflict prevention and peacebuilding can be. President Trump also signed into law the Elie Wiesel Genocide and Atrocity Prevention Act in 2019. That legislation made it in the core national interest of the United States to prevent mass atrocities and genocide around the world. The U.S. has continued to invest $6 million over the last several years in doing the work of atrocities and genocide prevention. And we've really seen important impacts as a result of that small amount of funding preventing really horrific violence. President Trump also signed the Women, Peace, and Security Act into legislation, which looks at how do we prevent violence against women and girls, protect women and girls in conflict situations, from the horrors of conflict-related sexual violence, displacement, and harm, as well as really looking at how can women be active participants? How can we engage women in building peace, in supporting peace processes, in being at the table as we look toward what a sustainable peace post-conflict looks like? And lastly, I just wanted to mention President Trump also signed into law the Nita M. Lowy Middle East Partnership for Peace Act. And that really invested in people-to-people reconciliation in the Middle East, really bringing together people across different divides, helping them find that shared humanity, helping them invest in those relationships. So all of this work, most of the peacebuilding work, is less than $150 million combined. It's a really small pot of money, but it goes so far in preventing violence, preventing human suffering, and increasing stability around the world.
So are you saying that the president is acting in contradiction to some of his earlier actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think we saw in the first Trump administration, while there were proposed cuts in the presidential budget request, you know, he did look at making a 30% cut to foreign assistance. He did, you know, want to make cuts previously. He also did sign into law several really important pieces of legislation that support this work that have now been really demolished by the actions of the foreign aid cuts at the start of this new Trump administration.
And Ursula Knudsen-Latta, you write, foreign assistance saves lives, invests in human dignity and growth, as you've been talking about human rights, and supports democracy. And so, you know, peace builders and human rights defenders, you say, who sought the U.S. as a partner for their futures have been abandoned essentially overnight. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, the way this foreign aid freeze and now termination took effect was that basically within a matter of hours, USAID staff were told, we're stopping all funding, reach out to all of your grantees and tell them to immediately stop work. And then at the same time, they were laying off USAID staff. So organizations received information saying you have to stop all work associated with your grants with the United States. And at the same time, the person that you've built a relationship with at USAID has now been laid off. So when you reach back out for clarification, there was no one there to answer your questions. And while here in Washington, there's more information sharing that's able to happen because we are staying on top of this news, but for millions of human rights activists around the world who are working in places like the Central African Republic, doing really important work to rebuild bridges between Muslim and Christian communities after intercommunal violence several years ago, they don't have those same connections. They get a message saying stop work and then no further contact. So there's been a lot of disruption, a lot of miscommunication globally as people sort of receive these memos and then don't know what to do next, and then later receive terminations. One of our partners who participated in the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance, they received PEPFAR money. PEPFAR is one of the world's leading initiatives to end the scourge of HIV and AIDS, and has had a huge global impact. They were receiving funding under this with a clinic in Kenya. The clinic then received instructions to say, okay, you can start some work, but we need you to commit to not do any DEI work. So the US-based staff member had to explain to the Kenyan clinicians, this is what DEI is. This is what these principles are that we are now being told not to use, even though that at many times is the best clinical practice to seek out those most at risk for HIV transmission, for AIDS. And so there's also just a lot of misunderstanding around what some of these things are and how it impacts the work globally.
Now, you cite a recent survey in a piece you have posted at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, where the vast majority of Americans support at least the 1% of the federal budget to foreign assistance, which is the current amount Congress had appropriated. And then the majority of Republicans, Democrats, and independents even supported more. So can you talk about that survey? But then also, what accounts then for this second Trump administration's pullback?
Yeah, so one common misunderstanding is how much foreign assistance actually accounts for in the U.S. federal budget. Currently, Congress appropriates less than 1% of the overall federal budget toward international foreign assistance. It is a very small percentage of our budget. However, for many Americans, they perceive it as up to 25% of the budget, in part because I think many people don't understand how big the federal budget is, but also it's something you might hear about and feel that it's a very expensive activity without, you know, having all the information available. And so when recently surveyed, many Americans said, oh yes, we'd support up to 5% of the federal budget, up to 10% of the federal budget going toward foreign assistance. Which is significantly more generous than our Congress has been over the last several decades. I think it's also important to mention many Americans after, you know, not through their taxes, but in their post-tax income, still give incredibly generously to these causes, whether through the pews and through faith-based organizations or through organizations like the Red Cross, Save the Children, that do really critical humanitarian work around the world. Many Americans are choosing to make generous contributions to that, understanding how important it is and how critical and life-saving this work is. And so we can't do it alone with just privately generated funds. The U.S. government's contribution is enormous and incredibly generous, even though it is only 1% of the federal budget.
Now, FCNL and Bread for the World a couple of weeks ago brought together the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance, had folks take action and went to speak to members of Congress. Can you talk about that action?
Yeah. So the Interfaith Working Group on Foreign Assistance brings together faith-based organizations from many different communities, Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, and others, to advocate for the world's most vulnerable and to advocate for poverty-focused development assistance, humanitarian assistance, and the like. And in recognition of how harmful these cuts were, how impactful these terminations were, we organized a really, on like kind of 2 weeks' notice, pulled together 16 participants from about a dozen different organizations across the faith spectrum to fly into DC and to lobby Congress. I think personally, one thing that really stood out to me was many of our Muslim colleagues were in the midst of Ramadan and were still choosing to fly in from Texas and around the country to say, this is something that's really important to us and we want to speak to Congress, even though we are fasting all day and then at the same time walking 4 to 7 miles across Capitol Hill between meeting after meeting and talking without being able to have a sip of water. I think it really just highlighted to me how strong folks' convictions were. And we had over a dozen meetings over the course of 2 days across Capitol Hill with Republicans, with Democrats, all really focused on the appropriations committees because they are the ones that write the spending bills and really calling on their conscience and our shared American values to help the least amongst us, to love thy neighbor. And, you know, it was a really powerful experience. And I think we heard from members of Congress how important faith voices are in this moment. So it was a really busy 2 days, but really inspiring and really powerful.
Now, what was the message? And what were you asking the members of Congress to do? And how can people participate in that?
Absolutely. So our main message is that these terminations are catastrophic, that the U.S. has had strong, consistent values towards foreign assistance for over 100 years. We have been giving from the federal budget to those around the world in need. And that Congress must act urgently to prevent the illegal impoundment of appropriated funds. What that means is if Congress says you have to spend $1 million on AIDS relief, the administration can choose how it spends that $1 million towards AIDS relief, but it needs to spend that money. It is required by Congress to spend that money. And right now, by terminating all of these contracts and choosing not to spend the money as appropriated by Congress, the administration is edging ever closer toward illegal impoundment of these funds. And that also fiscal year 26 is coming up, and we have to keep a really strong foreign assistance spending in the fiscal year 26 budget. The federal fiscal year starts October 1st. So we are less than 5 months away from the start of the next fiscal year. And Congress has a really important role in standing up to the president's actions and continuing to invest in foreign assistance. All of your listeners, all of their friends and friends of friends can help make their voice heard on this by going to fcnl.org/saveaid. And that'll give them a quick and easy tool to send a letter to their member of Congress. It lets you customize the letter so you can share why you think foreign assistance is important. But it's fcnl.org/saveaid to make your voice heard as well.
And while there, you can look at Ursula Knudsen, Lata's piece, Foreign Aid Terminations Endanger Millions at Home and Abroad. You can look at that survey that people support this across the political spectrum, beyond what we currently have appropriated that has been cut. So, you know, the moral moment, I know Bridget Moix talks about that. You know, when you talk to people, people aren't saying that they're against it, but what you want is people to step forward to support it. And are people afraid to do that when you were talking to members of Congress? What's the challenge?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge facing Congress right now, on one hand, is the really sharp partisan divides and sort of fear of working with other parties at times, fear of stepping out of line with your own party. So we have seen many members of Congress speak up. We have seen Republicans and Democrats speak up. However, there are fewer Republicans and their voices are not as loud. I think it's really important that both parties are speaking with a really clear voice on this. The USAID previously spent about $1 billion buying commodities and goods from US farmers to then share with those who are hungry around the world. When those commodity shipments got cut off, when those contracts got terminated, we did see several Republicans step up and speak out in support of that important food assistance from farm states. So we really appreciate that. We appreciate that they understand how these foreign assistance terminations impact in their home states. But we need even more. We need even more Republicans to speak out and Democrats to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans in restoring all of this foreign assistance. We've appreciated, Congressman Young Kim from California has had a really clear perspective on this from the beginning. While a Republican, she has been speaking out for several months in support of foreign assistance, recognizing how important it has been. And so, we appreciate it. There are Republicans speaking out, but we need even more. And we need even more Democrats speaking out. Not all of them have made statements yet. So there's work to be done on both sides of the aisle.
So what's the time frame on this?
So at the moment, we are looking at, 18 to 50,000 American jobs lost already, 170,000 jobs lost globally. The longer that this continues, the longer that these terminations remain in place, that will continue to worsen. We're seeing thousands of preventable deaths from AIDS already. The longer this continues, the worse it will be. There is a fear that while the current contracts have been terminated, or the previous contracts have been terminated, new contracts will not be issued. New calls for proposals for grants will not be issued. And that the billions of dollars that have been cut will not be spent. And that this food assistance, that this humanitarian aid, that this medical assistance will not reach millions of people around the world who desperately need it. And the longer that goes on, the more severe the impacts will be. Right now, as I said, this fiscal year ends September 30th. So there will really be kind of a clear understanding by September 30th whether the administration intends to spend any of its remaining funds. And Congress has the next 4 months to pass a state foreign operations bill to reinvest in foreign assistance and really show that they continue to support this work, even if the administration is obstructing it. So they have until September 30th to pass the fiscal year 26 spending bills to support foreign assistance.
Thank you. I'm speaking with Ursula Knudsen-Lata. She's the Legislative Director for Peace Building at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, where she lobbies Congress to establish peace building as a central goal of U.S. foreign policy. And you can look for the how you can support the action to restore the funding to foreign aid programs now at a 90% cut. And you can find this at the fcnl.org website. And also look for Ursula Knudsen Lata's pieces. So, hey, thank you for joining me this morning. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
It's 8:32. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back with Omar Ocampo from inequality.org.
Let me tell you about my baby. She makes poor heart skip a beat. Now I love her and don't think maybe she knocks me off my feet. Ain't never no pushing, shoving. Let me tell you, man, she's the best. I give her all my loving. My baby do the rest. She's hard to find.
It's about 8:33, and thank you to Omar Ocampo. He's standing by. He is a researcher in the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies. And I wanted to talk with him about his latest piece at inequality.org titled Liberation Day Tariffs Will Concentrate Wealth More. So Omar Ocampo says that Trump's trade war is a class war designed not to revitalize American manufacturing, but to weaken progressive taxation. To boost domestic manufacturing, tariffs need to be implemented and targeted. Higher prices may boost corporate profits if consumption levels remain constant, but there's no guarantee that this extra revenue will be invested into expanding the productive capacity of the country. If anything, tariffs will exacerbate the already existing problem of extreme inequality, he says. When the economic pie of the rich expands, they will use their new resources to extract more wealth from the working class through the acquisition of critical assets like residential housing and infrastructure we rely on. Well, you know, Omar, I'm so glad to have you. I needed this piece right at the moment I saw it. I had some questions gnawing away at me about the problems created by NAFTA and free trade. I saw Sean Fain. And just to be clear, he and the United Auto Workers are not sure about all the tariffs, but favors those for his industry. So I appreciate your piece. I appreciate you directing in your piece to Matthew C. Klein's book, Trade Wars are Class Wars. So lots for your intro, Omar, but thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here again, Jan, so thank you for the invite.
So what I appreciated about your piece is how it was easy to understand and that you honed in on whether or not what was the reason for these sort of mass tariffs rather than some targeted tariffs. So this idea of the trade war is a class war designed to weaken, not to revitalize American manufacturing, but to weaken progressive taxation. Can we start there? That's where I had the questions the most. They're not designed, you say, to revitalize American manufacturing. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So, like you said, I mean, I would say that there are three reasons that stick out for why Trump is trying to do these tariffs. And the first is to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. and revitalize its industrial base with good paying jobs. You know, with the logic that this will uplift the standards of the standards of living of the working class. And the second is directly linked to the first, and that it wants to rebalance trade with so the country can begin to pay down or at least slow down the growth of the national debt. But one thing that a lot of people are missing is that the purpose of these tariffs is that it's a slow, gradual dismantlement of progressive taxation, because according to the Trump administration, the tariffs are going to bring in so much revenue that we can finally pay off the national debt and we'll begin to run trade surpluses to the point that an income tax is no longer relevant and it no longer makes sense to have it. And, through his logic, we can fund, public goods and services with the revenue raised from tariffs. But in my opinion, the only goal that has any real chance of succeeding in the next 4 years, out of the three that I just mentioned, is the weakening of progressive taxation. And I think a lot of Trump's declarations also undermines his idea, this idea that they're going to raise a significant amount of revenue, because he says, all right, I'm going to impose these tariffs on country X, but yet this country X is welcome to negotiate. And the fact that we're going to negotiate the elimination of tariffs or the lowering of tariffs just, to me, completely undermines this whole idea of raising significant revenue. So this is one of the another thing that to keep in mind, that this is also going to be accompanied by a tax cut that's coming in the pipeline. So he's going to lower taxes on the ultra wealthy and on the highest income bracket. He wants to lower corporate tax. So to me, this is just a wealth transfer, because now the working class and middle to low income individuals are going to have a higher burden of taxation. And that is going to be funneled to the corporations and the wealthy.
So, the argument that these broad tariffs is critical to ushering in a new era of American prosperity does not hold up to scrutiny. I'm going to say that. Can you say more about the non-strategic then? So this deployments, you write, will not make American manufacturing great again. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, so it's non-strategic because, I mean, it's interesting because one of the questions a lot of people came up with was, where did he come up with this? The day he did that press conference when he was holding up that sign that says, hey, this is going to be the tariffs for different countries. A lot of people were confused about, how did he come up with these rates? I mean, there is a baseline tariff of like 10%, but I've been reading some experts who are saying, to actually bring back manufacturing, there has to be, tariffs are going to actually have to be a lot higher, to maybe to the point of 300%. And that, you know, because the thing is that we need to have the corporations be, you know, incentivized to, you know, to want to invest in the United States. And I think that they're not going to do so mainly because of the things are so much more expensive here. And one thing that's missing out of this whole conversation is the American corporation, the multinational, because no one forced them to go relocate and offshore their plants to abroad. But yet somehow it's the different countries, and you know, whether it's China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, these are the countries that are getting blamed for these imbalances, when it was actually the profit maximization strategy of American corporations that decided to go abroad and do their plants over there. And yet, you know, they're being rewarded with tax cuts. Then, you know, I would argue that the best way to, you know, proceed forward is basically to you know, to levy taxes on the higher taxes on American corporations, and then use that tax revenue to basically, you know, invest in the U.S. public, whether that's investing in the green transition and, you know, some good public sector jobs, you know, goods and services that are, you know, available to the public. But that's not what they're doing. So to me, this is completely on upside its head. I think they got it all wrong, and yes. And there's also no plan, no strategy. I've said in my piece, it's like, you know, a lot of the profits that the corporations have been able to make over the past, you know, 40, 50 years. Last year, corporate profits were at its highest, but you know, there's no industrial plan. How are we going to guarantee that a lot of these profits are not just going to go to excessive executive pay or to share buybacks or to dividend distributions? That would actually require an industrial plan, and to me, that doesn't look like Donald Trump has one.
The so if you were to really be trying to make American manufacturing great again, it would need substantially higher tariffs, and you would need to provide some kind of subsidy to the industries, then that would be impacted, right? But that is not being done. That those are being cut.
Correct, and there's also no plan outside of the tariffs. That's the main thing, and this is why Trump's tariffs are madness. It's madness because I do think that right now is an important time for progressives and the left to actually think about what an alternative progressive fair policy looks like. I think it's also important not to disregard tariffs, mainly because when it is targeted to protect and develop a certain industry, it can help. It can help it along the way, so it can build itself up and be ready to compete on the international market. And this is how nearly every single economy has developed, over the past few centuries, with the very few exceptions. I think, you know, Netherlands and Switzerland were the only, economies that developed without protectionism. But every single other country has developed with protectionism, tariffs, subsidies, not through the free trade or free market, but they all were all accompanied by a strategy in order to build up the productive capacity of the country or of the certain industry. So,
That makes so much sense. We hear, you know, business talking heads out there saying all tariffs are bad, but in fact they are. And that's not what you're saying. You're saying there needs to be a more nuanced agenda, right?
Correct, and it's completely not nuanced the way that the Trump administration is deploying it, and I think that, you know, for the future, for when we think about progressive alternatives, I would like to see how we can develop mechanisms or institutions that allow for some democratic input from labor organizations, environmental groups. I think what is part of what has been fueling our crisis for the past 50 years is the lack of democracy and the fact that a lot of decisions are made by technocrats who are being lobbied by oligarchs and large corporations who are basically concentrating, you know, market share or power in their hands. So I would like to see the benefits of, you know, tariffs be distributed to, you know, at least a decision making on and the benefits of tariffs to be have some input and be distributed to the workers and these groups that have a stake in the game.
So the trade wars or class wars, the global trading system has failed workers in the U.S. and elsewhere. But this is not the solution.
The solution that Trump is advancing is not the solution, mainly because it's across the board, it's non-strategic. The deployment is, you know, follows no real logic. It has been speculated that, you know, the way he came up with these different tariffs for different countries was through ChatGPT. Not sure that's true, but it wouldn't surprise me. Other people have speculated that, you know, Trump would just look at the trade deficit that the U.S. has with a specific country and then divide it by imports. This is how they get their, you know, their tariff rate. It makes absolutely no sense. And not only that, you know, bringing back manufacturing is also such a long-term process. You know, a factory does not get built in 6 months. This takes years, you know.
So when the president, who's he talking to when he says, no, this is going to hurt a little bit, but it'll be better for you in the long run? You know, who's he talking to? Oh, I think we lost Omar. We'll find him. Do we have Omar? You know, he writes, hi, Omar. Omar Ocampo writes in his piece at inequality.org, posted on April 2nd, high net worth individuals have no reason to be nervous or anxious because they are set to see long-term monetary gains because they do have resources to adapt and make decisions that expand their capital. And then not to mention, he writes, that they are set to receive a tax cut. I think we lost him, but we're going to get Omar Ocampo back. So the idea, you know, that this is a short-term pain for long-term gains is speaking to the highest net worth individuals. Meanwhile, those who are reliant on their retirements, for instance, less able to adapt to this kind of economic circumstance. So it's a piece that I would really recommend. Like all of the inequality.org pieces, you know, they make clear critiques of the issue and then give us some links to a lot of important facts. Hey, Omar, I'm glad we have you back. The Omar Ocampo researcher at the Program on Inequality and the Public Common Good. So when the president says that, you know, folks, this is just going to be some pain now, but things will be better, you know, I think, and you write, that it's really for the highest net worth people, right?
Correct. The thing is that the people who have, you know, a lot of resources or their high net worth, they were able to adapt properly to whatever Trump's plan is. Unfortunately, Trump is so erratic and so volatile that they haven't been able to adapt properly. But once Trump decides on a decision, then they will be able to, you know, to properly make the adjustments and make the necessary, you know, investments, whether that's through something productive or through some, you know, through the investment of, you know, something speculative on a speculative assets, that remains to be seen. But they will be able to adjust. The people who are actually going to suffer are going to be the American consumer and the American working class, because they're going to have the burden. They're going to be the tax burden is going to be imposed upon them. You know, The Trump administration is somehow not, you know, saying, hey, you know what, we're going to lower, you know, make housing more affordable. We're going to lower healthcare costs, or even provide universal healthcare, or we're going to, you know, have some type of relief for the bottom 50%. They're not doing any of that. So therefore, the working class are going to get squeezed and their living standards are going to get squeezed. Meanwhile, the people who are at the top, they're able to adjust. And not only that, that they're going to be the main primary beneficiaries from these tariffs, because, you know, they own a significant size of the debt, the top 1% of households. And so when you have, a tax cut at the top and then basically increase in taxes for, the rest of society, that revenue gets scooped up and then it gets transferred into the pockets of the top 1% through interest payments for the national debt, because they own a big part of it. And then when the government is going to fail to actually raise the revenue that they say they're going to raise, they're going to end up borrowing from the people they should be taxing. So this is why, one of the reasons why it is going to be a wealth transfer, and which is why they're going to do well in the medium term to long term. Short term, I'm not sure, because Trump seems to change his mind every 4 hours, because in the morning he says one thing and then by the evening it's another thing. And so that creates volatility, and which is why there's a lot of negative reactions. But once there's something in place, the top 1% can adjust.
You know, the message, you know, there is a populist message that I think people respond to, and that... when people start to unpack it, they just start spinning it. I notice it. And then people try to impact it, and then they spin it again. And I'm going to say quite artfully in some ways. Like, I can just picture them in a war room saying, let's say it this way, when this gets challenged. But, you know, this message is appealing. People want help. Targeted tariffs could help. But this is not it, is what you are talking about. And there's really no reason to believe that any kind of additional profit is going to be used to support the working class, right?
Correct. There is no mechanism in place that will ensure or force some type of profit sharing, some type of labor rights. I'm not sure that American corporations are, I can say this with confidence, American corporations are not very big fans of unions. Otherwise, they wouldn't be spending so much of their resources trying to dismantle any type of worker organizing. They're not in favor of, any environmental rights. The benefits that, if any, that come out of these widespread tariffs that are, indiscriminately deployed, if there are any benefits, there's no guarantee that this will be shared. You know, the over the past 50, 60 years, the labor share of income, so the amount of income that gets generated in a year and the share of it that goes to labor, has been in a gradual decline ever since the 1970s. And there's nothing that guarantees, even if we bring back manufacturing, that this will reverse this trend. Another thing that we're going to have to debate about is how are we going to distribute the surplus that is generated. And if the past 50 years are any indication, is that a lot of this gets basically captured by the big corporations and the ultra wealthy, and they distribute it through dividends, stock buybacks, executive pay, but then they also invest in a lot of things in our lives. So, for example, residential housing. So now you have a lot of private investors, investing their money in this sector, and this raises the price. The working class are unable to compete with the resources of the ultra wealthy. So this is why everything is also getting more expensive. Now, through asset management firms, they'll invest the resources of the ultra wealthy into buying toll booths, into buying schools, into buying hospitals, and they normally lower the quality of these things, but yet raising the price, which is also another, an indirect form of wealth transfer, because when you pay a higher fee, who that fee is going to be distributed to the asset management firm and to the ultra wealthy investor. So this is why I would say that this is a class war, because this is squeezing the living standards of the working class while expanding the wealth of the top 1%.
Omar Ocampo, and we're just getting warmed up here, but we have to say so long for now. Ocampo is a researcher at the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. You can read his piece dated April 2nd at inequality.org. Great to talk with you, Omar. It was an important discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jen, for having me. I look forward to coming back.
And now from more news, this piece originally aired on Monday. Amin Madison took part in the nationwide hands-off protest. So here's that piece.
My sign says pro-America, anti-Trump. We the people reject Project 2025.
Keep your tiny effing hands off my child's special education.
I miss Nixon.
Pro-America, anti-Trump.
Those were some of the messages protesters in Madison had for President Donald Trump and billionaire Elon Musk on Saturday at the hands-off protest, one of over 1,300 such protests that took place around the country over the weekend.
Hands off!
Beginning around noon, a crowd of some several thousand crowded the steps of the Capitol and extended down State Street. In some places, they were packed so close together it was difficult to move. They made their causes known through chants, costumes, and homemade signs.
My sign says, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law," which is in the 14th Amendment. So unless they've taken that away, people should still get due process. I am sick of seeing people on the news getting kidnapped by undercover cops and thrown in vans.
Yeah. One of our friends wanted to come here today, but they were afraid to come to the protest because they thought they might get snatched. Yeah.
The protest drew folks from across the state, some from around the country, and from both sides of the aisle. In addition to protesting with her husband, Myra Kemna was volunteering as a medic at the protest.
You know, actually, I'm a registered Republican, but to wake up and see everything that's going on is just horrific. Nobody's paying attention to the rule of law, and the Republican congressmen and senators are just letting it happen. So, you know, any of us, I'm in healthcare, and to see how they're going about dismantling all these programs is just asinine, in my opinion. So, yeah, that's why we're out here, and rule of law needs to reign again, and we just need everybody's support.
Trump, Musk, and other government officials have claimed that people who protest against Trump's administration have been paid to show up and agitate crowds. But at least one protester Saturday assured WORT reporter Brian Standing that wasn't the case.
Not at all. It cost me about $1 in gas to get down here from the Far East Side.
Do you protest a lot? Is this something that you do regularly, or were you inspired today?
No, I'm newly inspired. The last time I walked around here with a sign was when Trump was first elected, and I said, the sign said, "Not my president." He's still not my president.
Despite the urgency of the changes protesters were calling for, the mood of the crowd was generally joyful, even playful. WORT News Director Sholly Pittman interviewed a group who created a papier-mâché effigy of Elon Musk.
People have to make dissent silly when they can to kind of put some gas back in their tank. And this is like a silly way to say what we want to say, you know? Because I think what we want to say is being said all over, you know? So what's a new way to say it and make sure that people are, you know, not just glancing at the signs, not looking at them anymore as we're out and about.
And Brian Standing spoke to a woman dressed as Big Bird from Sesame Street.
What inspired you to come down here today?
Big Bird drew the line for me. That was the line for me. It's like when you start taking on Big Bird, you got a problem.
You took that personally.
I do. My kids learned a lot from Sesame Street about diversity. It was kind of a main theme of that.
Many hoped that the energy from the protest would resonate long after the crowd cleared out around 3 p.m. Mayor Ann Groves Lloyd of Lodi brought along several Lodi residents to distribute 600 stickers picturing Trump with the line, "I did that."
We want people to put them in grocery stores and buy the shoe prices in department stores, just to remind people why we're in this situation. He inherited a very good economy. He took a dump on it, and he has to own what's happening right now, and it's going to affect every one of us.
For many in the crowd, Saturday marked their first protest, but as one woman told Brian Standing, not their last.
What got you down here today?
It's just been too much. It's just too far. It's blatant discrimination and attack on our way of life and freedom.
Do you see a way forward?
I think this is the first step. I think standing up for our rights is the first step.
For WORT News in Madison, Wisconsin, I'm Jess Miller. Brian Standing, Eric Schwertfeger, and Shali Pittman contributed reporting.
And that is from WORT News Monday evening program. Thank you to Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer, and Miss Tina, our receptionist. I'm Jan Misaki, and I will talk with you next week.
It's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. Your listener responds to community radio stations. Stay tuned for the Insurgent Radio Kiosk, and then Nate's in the house, so let's see where he takes us.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 9.
You're invited to the Anti-War Cafe in Madison on April the 12th, Saturday, from noon to 3 at The Crossing, 1127 University Avenue, UW campus.
The cafe is a new monthly Madison gathering of anti-war and anti-genocide activists. Time to be together, plan for action, make music and art, and eat and drink. This month, we're featuring an open mic for music and spoken word, arts and crafts, and small group discussions with Stefani Sani on war tax resistance and with John Peck on previous divestment struggles at UW-Madison, South Africa, Burma, Sudan, and Palestine, and how they relate to the anti-genocide divestment campaign ongoing at UW-Madison now.
The Crossing is on campus and easy to reach by bus, bike, and walking. There's free parking nearby on weekends at UW lots 34 and 20.
Can you help make the Anti-War Cafe a success by doing any of these things? Bring music or words for the open mic, bring fruit or drink, or lead a small group conversation on an anti-war topic of your choice, as well as a small group project, art, or craft, and as well, public.